From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Barack Obama says no to public financing, and the levees break once again, this time in the Midwest. Did the federal government learn from Katrina? Our reporters give us their take on our weekly roundtable. Today we have Frederica Whitfield. She's an anchor for CNN on CNN's Newsroom, and Eric Deggans. He's a media critic for the St. Petersburg Times. Hi, folks.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm doing great, Frederica. Great to talk to you. So let's talk a little bit about Barack Obama. He is making big waves because he will not accept public financing in the general election. This is the first presidential race where anyone's opted out of public financing for the general election since 1976. Why is that important?
Well, it's important because it really does underscore Obama's ability to fundraise. That's in part what he is saying. We've been able to see these record money-making fundraising abilities since, I guess, the start of the primary season, from $30 million in one quarter at a time. You know, but when he is saying in an email to his supporters that public financing allows, quote-unquote, special interests to drown out the voices of the American people, and he's asking supporters to declare our independence from a broken system, it's going to be hard for a lot of voters to be outraged that he says, I'm not accepting federal funding, public money. John McCain is saying he's being dishonest. This exemplifies that he's a flip-flopper. And I think voters as a whole aren't as focused in on the money-raising abilities and the availability of public funding as these candidates are. So it will be interesting to see if the voters seem to agree with McCain that he is being dishonest, that he's going back on his word initially that he would be accepting public funding, and now he says, well, instead I can raise the money on my own, and I don't want to accept public money if it means also being grasped by the tentacles of special interest groups or lobbyists or PACs.
You know, Eric, from a media perspective, since you are a media analyst, how does this play? Because he said, Barack Obama said, that he would do one thing and now he's doing another. Do people who are not in the media business and not in the political business really care?
Well, that's the big question. I do think that the open question is whether or not the average voter will care. But I also think this is one of the key issues that John McCain is going to use to attack Obama, not fundraising, but can you trust him? Will he do what he says he's going to do? Until now, Barack Obama has presented himself as the kind of candidate who will take a principled stand and will forego things that may be advantages to him as a politician in favor of being honest with voters and being a different kind of leader. And what he's shown right now is that he's doing the kind of thing that the Clintons used to do, which is, you know, say one thing and then do another if it becomes politically more advantageous. So I think he's going to have to be careful about making moves like this, even when they make sense. And the other thing we have to watch is who will be donating to his campaigns. I mean, we're assuming that he's going to get a lot of his money from the internet because that's where he's gotten it before. But if he foregoes public financing and some of the controls that come with it, who knows where this money is going to come from?
Frederica, I want to move on actually to a different campaign issue also around Senator Obama. So on Monday, two Muslim women attended an Obama rally. They were wearing the hijab, the traditional headscarf. Some campaign volunteers told them they could not sit in an area behind the candidate where there'd be media cameras trained on them. The campaign says it didn't know the volunteers had removed the women from the area. The Obama camp has apologized, and the senator reportedly personally called the women to apologize. Now, there's been these rumors circulating that Obama is a Muslim. If you see polls, there are many people who think he's a Muslim, although he has never been a Muslim. But does this incident show that his team has gone too far in trying to protect his image?
Yeah, I think it does underscore that it is very precarious for the Obama as an individual and for he as a politician, as the nominee for the Democratic Party. While his, you know, senior advisor, Anita Dunn, said this does not in any way reflect the orientation of the campaign, it is difficult for people to remove supporters, people who volunteers, those, whether they be on volunteer or on staff working for Obama, to separate the two. while Obama and his campaign now have to work hard at his image, and that really is what we're seeing as of late, particularly after being named the presumptive nominee, that he's working hard on his image. The image of his wife is also one that is front and center right now. You're seeing Obama say, and his people underscore, they are Christians, they are church-loving, they're a family. She's compassionate and supportive. She's not the angry woman. He's thoughtful, and he has open arms really uniting his campaign, and he, too, will be one to unite the party. It's going to be very difficult still for a lot of folks who are doubting his affiliation, whether it be with the Muslim community or whether they're still doubting his relationship with Jeremiah Wright. I think this is a terrible gaffe to take place. While it may not have been the presumptive nominee who actually asked these young ladies to move their seat, it's nearly tantamount to that because these are his supporters. These are people working on his campaign.
Eric, how do you think this is going to play out over the campaign? Because there's this whole question of, you know, swift voting and truth squatting. And, you know, Senator Obama has this whole, you know, website set up specifically to rebut rumors. So there's definitely a role in every single campaign for trying to protect your image. But particularly in a campaign that is kind of throwing out the we are the world, you know, everyone grasp hands, this is the new America image. Sure. Isn't this problematic?
Well, I'd say there's two things that jump out at me about this. The first is that Obama, there's these growing murmurs that he has problems with press relations, that his people are too heavy-handed, they don't give enough access to the candidate, and that John McCain is much better at charming the press than Obama is. So, again, I think this is more a reflection of that. You know, they are having a hard time, a difficult time, figuring out how to present Obama in a way that doesn't shut down the press and seem too heavy-handed. And I think they're going to have to develop a more nuanced way of dealing with these issues. Otherwise, it's going to backfire. The other thing that's going on here is that Muslims, frankly, are concerned because Barack Obama doesn't attack the central issue at the heart of a lot of these issues, which is that what's wrong with being Muslim?
Right.
He gets out there and he says, I'm not a Muslim, and sort of seeds the idea that if he were a Muslim, there would be a problem. And so I think he's going to have to be careful, again, about sort of going along with the underlying notion of some of these things, which is that being associated with Muslims is something that's bad.
Right. If I could just underscore on that, that, you know, that's a really great point because, you know, in part what we're seeing, we're seeing that the word Muslim is being used like it's a dirty word. Like, oh, no. You know, if he had any affiliation with the Muslim faith way back when or even now, it's a terrible thing and that Americans should shut down. And I think he has a responsibility, just as his campaign does, to come out and say something or address this issue that, you know, while I may want to dispel whatever, you know, connection someone is trying to make about me and my active affiliation or past relationship with the Muslim community, you know, state the facts what they are, but to also underscore it's important to say to Americans and to the rest of the world that we're not allowing anyone to use this word Muslim as though it's a dirty word, as though it's a terrible thing to be associated with, because it's a dangerous place that we'll be heading, especially when we're talking about a candidate who has made it very clear that he's willing to reach out and talk, that he wants to push forth diplomacy if indeed he ends up in the White House, and that would be with just about anyone. And, of course, that includes the Muslim community or any leaders or countries with a populace of Muslims.
And that the next president will definitely deal with that. So we have just a little bit of time left for a kind of speed round question. There have been these massive tragic floods in the Midwest, especially Iowa. Levees along the Mississippi River are breaking and flooding small towns. And the levees broke in New Orleans after Katrina. Does the government's response this time show that they've learned something, Eric?
I guess it shows they've learned a little bit. I'm, again, because of my concentration, I'm focusing on the media, and I wonder if the media has learned anything here. You know, we spent a lot of time, the big media, talking about the death of Tim Russert, for example, while these communities were facing some pretty steep hazards. And I think it was surprising to some people to turn on their cable TV news channels and see saturation coverage of Tim Russert's death when you had average ordinary people losing their homes and seeing these waters threaten. So I would say the media has some catching up to do here to inform people about just how bad this crisis is, because I don't think most of the country sees this as a new Katrina yet.
Right. There's actually been cases of some people making unfavorable comparisons, Frederica, saying that basically the people in the Midwest had their act together and those people in New Orleans did not. Do you think that there's some racial coding going on in the blogosphere?
Well, it's certainly not fair to make the comparisons, because we're talking about, I mean, geographically, you couldn't have more different areas. I mean, we're talking about the Gulf Coast that is much more densely populated than some of these Midwest communities that have been inundated by the floodwaters in terms of just per square footage. I think, though, what this helps to underscore is that the levees in this country as a whole, whether you're in the Gulf Coast or whether it's Illinois or whether it's Iowa, all of them need to be re-examined. And perhaps what should have happened immediately following Katrina, to see the kind of breaching that took place and the calamity that followed, is that a full-out press should have taken place in terms of the Army Corps of Engineers to look at all of these levees in highly populated areas to see what they would be able to withstand. And I think it's just too soon, just 4 years after Katrina, to expect that all the levees in this country would be better secured as a result of what happened.
All right. We're going to have to wrap it up. But Frederica and Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were speaking with Eric Dagans, media critic for the St. Petersburg Times. He spoke with us from the studios at the Poynter Institute, and Frederica Whitfield, anchor for CNN Newsroom. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Sex is everywhere. It's on TV, online, and on the minds of your children. Nearly half of all high schoolers say they've already had sex. That's according to the National Center for Health Statistics. And if that isn't enough to panic many parents, then what about the talk? You know, the big talk about sex. For small kids, it could be, where do babies come from? For teens, it might include some frank information about sexually transmitted diseases. So how do you start the conversation, and what should you say? For some advice, we've got Dr. Sharon Maxwell. She's a clinical psychologist and author of The Talk, What Your Kids Need to Hear from You About Sex. Dr. Maxwell, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
So you start your book by talking about a conversation you had with your young son. Tell us about what prompted that.
Well, he was 7 years old. He got in the car, put a seatbelt on, and he said to me, "Mom, do you know what a hooker and a stripper are?" And I was a little bit floored, because I had been pretty much the mother from hell in terms of making sure that I knew everything he had ever seen. And I was the one that was acculturating my children. I wasn't having the media do it. And what the story turned out to be is he'd been at the playground that day, and a bunch of boys had been talking about a video game that one of them had been playing. He told me that, "Mom, you know, if you kill enough people, you get to go into a room where a lady takes off her top. That's what a stripper is. And if you kill more people and you get to a higher level of the game, you get to go into a room where a lady takes off all her clothes. That's what a hooker is." Well, needless to say, I was really floored, because without anything coming from me or the home, he already had in his mind a connection between violence and killing and sexuality.
So what did you do?
Well, I started to think long and hard. I mean, I was a psychologist anyway, and I saw a lot of teens. I also saw that there was a whole attitude about sexuality that I was seeing in my office that was very different than anything I'd seen before. And I started to think about, well, how can I begin to talk about sex with my own kids and with these teens in a way that's going to empower them, but also fill in some of the gaps that's missing? Like, it's not just about what are they doing or an anatomy lesson. It's not just about sexually transmitted diseases. It's about sexual desire. It's about the power of sexy. It's about being sold this idea that it's so very important to have this power, because that's how you get attention.
Now, you obviously can't control the entire media if you're a parent. And how much do you think you can even control what your kids see? I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, you were trying to be a very, very hands-on parent, and yet you couldn't ultimately control what your son saw, or what at least he heard.
Exactly. And this is why I ended up thinking so much about this and writing the book, because it was really clear to me that, you know, short of moving into a cave, there was absolutely nothing I could do to prevent him from understanding what a man, how a man uses his sexuality in a very negative way, and that I needed to get there first. I needed to give him a frame of reference to be thinking about sexuality differently. And even though he was only seven, I had to move in and start talking.
So give us some specifics. When you're talking to a seven-year-old, what do you say? Because there's some level of sophistication. They can do all sorts of things and understand all sorts of words. But then there's a lot of stuff that a seven-year-old may not understand.
Absolutely. And I think parents should know that the average age for kids in America hearing about sex, hearing about sexual intercourse, is 8 years old. And most of them hearing about it is either in the playground, on a school bus. They're not getting good information. They're not getting it in a way that the parent would like them to. So first of all, you get in there and you actually do the biology lesson, and you do it well, and you do it with a book that has some pictures. And, you know, you kind of take a deep breath and you just say, this is sex. There's a lot more to the story than that. It's something that happens when you become a big person, not now, but I'm going to tell you about it because it's so important, and I want you to understand how our family thinks about this, because you're going to be hearing a lot of stuff out there.
What about if you haven't had the talk and then you figure out, well, I guess we should have the talk, but your kid's like 13 years old. How does that change things?
Well, you know, first of all, be ready for them to tell you that they don't need to hear anything because they know it all already. Be ready for them to roll their eyes and walk out of the room. You have to do it anyway. Because you're not, at that point, you're not giving them what is sex. They know it already. You might want to go there, but in fact, you can be pretty sure that they're understanding that. What you're trying to do at that point is raise a child who understands how to use their sexual energy in a healthy, respectful, ethical way. And that's no easy task in a culture that's really selling them to kind of work their sexy as much as they can as a way of getting attention and power. You know, you have to come to terms yourself with how you feel about sexuality and this power of sexy thing that's being sold to the kids. And you have to say, listen, this is how I feel about it. I understand you're going to be making decisions on your own, but I'd like to hear how you think about it because it's such a big topic. The same way we don't send them out into the world to with the power of a car, you know, without giving them driver ed. Well, you know, they have the power of their sexuality, all that sexual energy inside of them. We're sending them out into a world that's really only about manipulating that for profit. And we haven't given them the basic instruction on how a good man and a good woman handles their sexual energy.
What do you think the role of the schools and the government is in sex ed? Because it's been incredibly controversial, both the idea of abstinence-only education, but even, you know, in some cases, people not wanting any form of sexual education. In other cases, in other communities or neighborhoods, people saying, well, let's have the condoms in the schools. There's a wide variety of responses, I guess, is what I'm saying. How do you think schools and neighborhoods should proceed?
I think we're thinking about it inaccurately. I mean, there's a part where we as a community must protect our kids from sexually transmitted diseases. There's an educational component. I think where we get into trouble is when we start to tell kids how to use their sexual energy. I think that's really the domain of the family. And if that family includes religious instruction, then the domain of religion. You know, parents have a right to let their kids know how they think sexual energy should be used and shouldn't be used. Schools, I think, have a right to protect the school body from sexually transmitted diseases and to inform about the basics that are going to keep kids safe. When it comes to what to do with the sexual energy, that's where I think each community has to decide, you know, how they want to go there. The reason I wrote this book, and I do teach a sexual health curriculum, but I always include the parents and I let them know I'm leaving this part to you and I'm going to be doing this part. But please don't ignore that other part because that's what they really need to hear about.
So you do a lot of consulting with not you know, you've written this book, but you also work on developing curricula that are used by other people in your absence. Give me an example of a couple things you might put in a curriculum.
Well, for example, I think it's incredibly important to talk about sexual desire. Now, parents are always saying to me, what do I do about the clothes? You know, they wear such provocative clothes. Well, in my curriculum, there's a whole part about desire and sexual energy. And I'll say to a group of fifth or sixth graders, you know, right now, what do you think the level of sexual energy in this room is? And they'll say, well, you know, 2 or 3 on a scale of 1 to 10. And I'll say, okay, so now imagine that a really good-looking, attractive lady walks into the room with a bikini on. What would happen to the sexual energy in the room? And they all, you know, giggle and they point their thumbs up and they say, well, it would go up. I said, yeah, imagine this. We have the power to shift the energy in the room simply by how we act, what we wear, and how we talk. Now, if we're conscious of that, then we understand we have a responsibility to the environment we're in at any given moment to keep the sexual energy at a place where it should be to accomplish what we're there to do. It gives you a way of talking about sexuality and sexual energy that lets a kid know that sexual energy can be manipulated. Theirs is being manipulated all the time by advertisers, as well as the fact that they have the power to manipulate other people's sexual energy, and that's what they're doing by how they talk and how they dress.
Any final tips for people who may, for example, have been listening to this and now be even more panicked about the talk that they have to give?
Well, the things that I really love to say to parents is you care about your kids. So that puts you head and tails above everybody else when it comes to talking about this. Even if you botch it really, really badly, you're way better than MTV.
Well, Dr. Maxwell, thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure.
Dr. Sharon Maxwell is a clinical psychologist and author of The Talk, What Your Kids Need to Hear from You About Sex. She was at member station WGBH in Boston. So what if you're someone who gives the talk to other teens? That's what 17-year-old Jacqueline Richards does. She recently graduated from high school in Long Island, New York, and has been a peer educator with Planned Parenthood for the past 2 years. Jacqueline, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. So you were hearing about Dr. Maxwell and her approach to sex and sexuality and the discussion between parents and kids. How do you think that conversation changes when you're talking about teen to teen?
Well, I think it's much better teen to teen because most of the teenagers, they kind of don't listen to their parents or adults. They think they don't know what they're talking about. And when you hear it from your friend or a peer, they kind of take it more seriously. They're like, oh, I didn't know that, you know, and they believe it more.
Give me an example of a conversation. And well, first of all, tell us what it means to do peer education. What kind of a, you know, a space are you in? How many people are you talking to? Just give us a visual for that.
Well, a teen advocate is basically a teenager's resource. We help teens who have questions or concerns regarding sex, sexuality, dating relationships, dating violence, and so on. And I kind of speak to roughly about 3 to 4 teenagers a day. And I'm constantly giving advice. And we reach out to teens in our classrooms, community centers, MySpace, Facebook. We do everything from performing skits to community outreach to talking one-on-one with teens. And because we care so much and our only concern is keeping teens healthy and safe, we advocate. Once a year, we'll go up to Albany and lobby legislators to pass the Healthy Teens Act, which is a piece of legislation that provides resources for schools to that give comprehensive sex education.
We talked a little bit with Dr. Maxwell about how sex ed is controversial in many neighborhoods, many communities, many government districts. Do you find that it is, you know, New York is not exactly known for being prudish, but at the same time, do you face opposition when it comes to doing things like lobbying around an issue like this?
I do. I recently just graduated from high school, and the high school I graduated from, we have to take a theology class. And a film that we were watching in theology dealt with some sexual content. And one of the lady in the film had said, my husband likes to see me pregnant, and he would poke holes in my diaphragm. And every female in that classroom raised their hand asking, you know, what's a diaphragm? Now, knowing that most of them were sexually active, I believe that they should have known what a diaphragm was. And I wasn't allowed to say what a diaphragm was because it was a theology classroom, and, you know, saying something about sex or anything involving the sexual act is against the religion.
So that's a clear case where your mission came up against other people's rules.
Yes.
How often does that happen?
In my school, it happened a lot. But it's same in public schools. I used to go to my Uniondale High School, where I live in Uniondale, but I attended a private school also, where it wasn't any different. Yes, they spoke about HIV and how it's transmitted, but they did not speak about how you can prevent it from happening.
So what do you think needs to happen? I mean, there's unfortunately, teens and people in their 20s are one of the fast-growing groups of people who get HIV. And this is, you know, 25 years after we started knowing about AIDS and HIV. What do you think will make a difference in terms of reaching people who may think, well, that's something that happened back then. I don't have to deal with it in my generation.
I think we just need the education. We need our parents to be open and honest. I mean, it worked for me and my mother. She was very open with me. And I know I hear a lot of parents say, well, if I teach my kid about sex or whatever that, you know, pertains to, they're going to go out and do it. And I'm one of those kids that, yes, I was spoken to about sex education, and I actually worked with Planned Parenthood where I was trained for the information to teach other kids about it. And I still abstain from sex. I still am a virgin, and I'm very proud to say that. We just need the education.
Why are you a virgin?
Why am I a virgin? Well,
it's the question I knew
it
would, might throw you, but I assume that it's a conscious decision. Why are you
it
still
is.
A virgin?
I would have to say, from all the things that I've learned, all the statistics that are out there, I mean, Uniondale is one of the most at-risk communities in Nassau County, and that scares me. And I'm not going to put myself out there and take that risk, especially if I know the kids who are sexually active are not being careful and taking that contraception that they, you know, supposed to take.
We just heard a statistic that about half of high school kids have had sex. That means about half haven't.
Yes.
What do you think is the difference in terms of people who make that choice? And do you view people who have gone ahead and had sex as making a bad choice?
I don't think someone who has had sex in high school is making a bad decision or they're a bad person or anything. I mean, there are so many reasons that I hear, oh, well, it was just in the moment, or, you know, things happen, or, you know, it was at a party, everyone's doing it. I mean, I hear that a lot almost every single day, and I can understand that. But all I always say is, you know, if you're going to be, you know, mature enough to go in and have that sexual act and do it, and you should be able to go to a store and buy the condoms that you need. I mean, males don't always have to carry the condoms. Females can carry it also.
So it sounds like responsibility is really what you're talking about.
Yes.
Well, Jacqueline, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Jacqueline Richards is a peer educator with Planned Parenthood. She recently graduated from high school in Long Island, New York, and will head off to the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York this August. Jacqueline joined us from WRHU on the campus of Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Now we've got our tech guru, Mario Armstrong, to fill us in on the news of the week, including a spat between the venerable Associated Press and bloggers, Yahoo's attempt to boost its strength in the area of webmail, and the news that 5 million songs have now been downloaded through iTunes. Mario, it's always great to have you on.
Hey, Farai. Glad to be here.
So the blogosphere flamed out last week after the AP lawyers blasted something called the Drudge Retort for its use of AP material. Since this is all a tongue twister for me, maybe you can explain it.
You know, here's the deal, right? AP is basically saying, and I think this is bigger than just the AP. I almost think that this is a sense of the feeling of traditional media, is that they basically view bloggers as freeloaders. That's essentially what they were kind of saying here. What they did is they handed down a really strong-handed move of a statement that basically said, look, we are threatening you and we will use the power of litigation if you quote material from the AP news source into your own blogs. And that's at the heart of the matter, why this old media versus new media battle isn't on everyone's minds right now.
What about that whole idea of fair use? Did this fall under fair use?
Yeah, that's been the blogger's position. The blogger's position that says, hey, this is in the parameters of fair use, which, you know, fair use allows other people to copyright, other people to, quote, copyrighted material, right? I mean, authors can do it. University researchers can do it. So they're saying, hey, we do the same thing. All we do as bloggers, that is contribute to a deeper two-way conversation that then happens online. Your article comes out or your news comes out. We take a snippet of that and start a discussion. And also what we do, what most bloggers say that they do as well, is drive traffic back to the AP or back to the news source where that snippet came from. So they feel that they're totally in the right of fair use.
There's been a little bit of a group hug, hasn't there? How have these guys worked it out?
Well, you know, there has been this little bit of a group hug. And I do want to give AP some credit for actually recognizing that. I think this was a good thing that they actually came a little heavy-handed, although I do think that they should have learned from the Recording Industry of America, Association of America, and others. But they have come back together, talked about this, and said, hey, look, we need to figure out ways that this doesn't jeopardize our business. AP's business, for those that don't know, they have paid members. News sources to the tune of about 1,500 daily papers pay for that service. So they're absolutely right in wanting to protect their intellectual property, especially if bloggers are copying and pasting a whole AP article and then making that seem like that's their material and then selling ads around that, that should be illegal. So they have made a group hug. They are working more around this. And I think things have relaxed a little bit since the fury started.
All right, let's turn to Yahoo, which is it has been fighting off Microsoft. Microsoft was courting it rather aggressively, but it's now got this deal to get revenue from Google Ads. And so explain to us how their mail system is being upgraded and how that relates to this whole Google Ads situation.
Yeah, this is an interesting scenario what we find ourselves in. So what they've launched is a ymail.com is the name of their new email address domains. That's what they're creating. I'll break this down real quickly. What it is they have two. They have now what's called Ymail and Rocket Mail. And what they're doing is they're basically trying to allow legacy users of Yahoo email and new users of Yahoo to get your own name at ymail.com or at rocketmail.com. Because right now, many people, you've probably seen this before, Farai, where you have like, Mario Armstrong 1984 5B at yahoo.com. And you're like, yeah. No one's going to remember that email address. So this is a play to get them to let their user base know, hey, we understand email is important. We want you to be able to have your name at a specific domain.com, in this case, Ymail or Rocketmail. And this will also allow Yahoo to reach out to new people because they use these email services as ways to put more advertising out there to their email subscribers.
Now, Ymail sounds suspiciously like Gmail.
I mean, you bring up a great point. I mean, Google launched their email service called Gmail, and it was well received initially by the tech community, and then it grew out of that. But what was different was the way email operated. They actually changed how you interfaced with email, which was different. And so now you have Ymail, and it's like, okay, so let me have one too. I could come up with Mario Mail, right, or M Mail. So it doesn't seem like there's some real creativity that's lacking there. So that does show a little bit of a sign of desperation, I think. On top of that, they make a lot of money through, and I mentioned this, these ad sales. And you brought this up with the whole Google Yahoo deal. What they're trying to do is keep the number one, which is Google, and the number two, Yahoo, ad sales on the internet companies come together to work for paid search, so that Yahoo could use Google and Google could use Yahoo. And so there's a lot of skepticism right now as to whether or not this is fair, and is this some antitrust issues here, and will this ultimately hurt competition and hurt consumers?
All right. I want to have a little bit of a chat about this. Apple, iTunes, 5 billion songs sold. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. It's a lot of songs. I'm responsible for some, but, you know.
You're right.
Nowhere near.
Many, right?
I didn't get to my first billion yet, so.
How many songs do you think you have on your MP3 player, roughly?
Oh, gosh.
Do you have over 1,000?
I can tell you in gigabytes. I have 40 gigabytes of music.
40 gigabytes. Okay, so you're doing pretty good. I mean, the average person actually carries around 1,700 songs. I had no idea. I don't carry that many songs with me.
Yeah.
So they launched this back in 2003. I don't know how, you know, in internet time, you start to forget how soon these things were launched, but it's been less than a little over 5 years, and over 5 billion songs. They have over 8 million tracks, and I did the math on this. It's what, 2.6 million songs every day that they've sold? 2.6 since iTunes started.
So we have to wrap up, but before we let you go, does this mean that the essential question of is the music industry going to die is resolved, meaning that people will pay for music, they're just going to pay for it online, or is that whole question of revenue for the music industry still very present?
Yeah, it's still very present. I don't think it's still very accurate. I think what this proves is that 5 billion songs is $5 billion. And so they are still saying that global music sales have dropped 8% to about $19.4 billion, according to the phonographic industry. So they are seeing some sales still decline, but you're seeing digital music rise. So I think these music labels are needing to get with the program and get over this fear of piracy and look at this saying, you know what, 5 billion songs, that's a lot of music that anyone could be buying. I mean, that's just, you know, at the end of the day, that's a lot of music to be purchased.
Mario, thanks so much.
Thank you, Farai.
Mario Armstrong is News and Notes regular technology contributor, and he joined us from the studios of the Baltimore Sun. Rough, rugged, and raw, that could describe the archetype of a hip-hop star or a down-low brother. The two are not mutually exclusive. According to author Terrence Dean, there are plenty of men in the hip-hop, television, and film industries who lead double lives, posing with glamorous women in public and sleeping with or having full-fledged relationships with men in private. Dean's book has garnered wide attention for its detail, including descriptions of stars given pseudonyms to hide their identity. His book is called Hiding in Hip-Hop, On the Down Low in the Entertainment Industry from Music to Hollywood. Terrence Dean, good to talk to you.
Oh, thank you. Hello, Farai. How are you?
I'm great. So let's start off with a little background on you.
Yes.
You, throughout the book, reference, it's in some ways a memoir as well as an investigation, and you reference a couple of moments in your childhood, one when you were just 4 and another one when you were being babysat at an older age. Can you just give us a hint of those?
Yeah. You indicate when I was 4 years old, I was with my mother at the time, and there was a man who was in the other room sexually assaulting my mother, and my grandmother came to pick me up because she generally did that once a weekend. And when she came to pick me up this particular weekend, this man who was sexually assaulting my mother, he came to the door and pushed my grandmother inside the room with me, tied her up with my mother's pantyhose, and put a gun to my head. And because I was crying, you know, because it was a very traumatic experience that I was going through, and I didn't know what was happening at that time. And so at 4 years old, I remember that, the recollection of that happening and the experience of that and the traumatization of that. And what I knew then and what I know now as a young boy growing up, and I said, wow, this is my first experience of what it is that my mother and who she is. And as it also relates to when I was 13 years old, the second incident when I was with a male next door neighbor at my cousin's home and was sexually assaulted at this again. And then it just, you know, it seemed like the play on it literally happened to myself. You know, at 4 years old, I witnessed it happening to my mother. At 13, it is happening to me.
So in some ways, it's remarkable that you were even as open to sex and sexuality as you were later in life, given some of the things you went through, because you describe scenes where you're in a world that is not open to most people, but you're able to, you know, hang out, flirt, be respectful. And one of the things that comes to mind is this whole scene you have at a taco and cards party.
Yeah, yes.
Taco and cards. It must be an LA thing.
Right.
And you find out that the entire party is basically full of folks on the down low. So
exactly.
What did you learn in Los Angeles about the way people who are in the industry and who are also on the down low socialize?
Well, I realized early on in my career as a man of color in this entertainment industry, because I had not seen a person of color who was openly gay in an executive decision-making role. I had never seen a producer, a director, or anyone of that capacity who was openly gay. So I knew early on, learning coming into this career in this culture, that I had to keep my sexuality a secret in order for me to advance. And once I got to L.A. and I started socializing with other men and women who were like myself, closeted men and women down low, but we created an environment where we can be amongst like-minded individuals, and such as you indicated, the taco car parties, where we can socialize, fraternize, and just help each other navigate this industry, because we knew, you know, we could not come out, because unfortunately in our community, in the Black community, there has not been a real dialogue or discussion about sex and sexuality, especially as it relates to homosexuality. And so the view and the idea of it is totally disregarded. So these people knew that they would jeopardize their careers, their livelihood, and even their family and friends. So that's why we created this atmosphere where in these individual homes that we can be amongst like-minded individuals and share and encourage one another. But again, it's very deceptive and very deceiving. I don't want to make it seem like it was, you know, something that I really want to pride myself on and being a part of, because it is very deceiving and deceptive to women who are unaware and a part of relationships that they have no clue that the men are sleeping with other men while they are leading these women to believe in their monogamous men and heterosexual men.
In fact, you had a relationship with someone that you call Charles, a hot
yes.
relationship, but
yes.
you ended it. Why?
Because Charles had a fiance. He had several women at the time, actually. But I also knew that I would never be number one in his life. And throughout the book, I do discuss, you know, for me, I was searching to be in a monogamous relationship with an individual, especially a same gender loving man such as myself. But I also realized in the entertainment business, that can never happen, because many of these men had wives, they had girlfriends. And in the case of Charles, he had a fiance, and he led me on thinking and hoping that, you know, somehow we were actually going to be in an intimate relationship one-on-one, until he, you know, divulged to me that that was impossible, that would never happen.
Well, let's go back to the industry side of this, because this is really a memoir of your life in the industry. There are many gay white men and
yes.
even lesbians, people like Ellen, who are incredibly powerful in Hollywood and in the entertainment industries across the board. Why is that not the case for, why can't there be the equivalence in the African-American world?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct, you know, and I state those claims before, you know, and, you know, like a Bill Gates, I mean, David Geffen, Ellen, Rosie, George Michael, John, Jolton John, Lance Bass, like a lot of these people, you know, unfortunately, our white counterparts and colleagues are able to come out of the closet. Their community supports them because, as I expressed in my book, they have a nurturing environment where, for them, sex and sexuality has always been a dialogue and a discussion within their community. They have communities where they exist, and they help support one another, especially out in Los Angeles. You have West Hollywood. In Atlanta, you know, you have the Midtown area. In D.C., you have DuPont, San Francisco. New York, you have Chelsea. But we don't have those types of individual communities for people of color, for same gender loving people. So we don't have an idea of what same gender loving gay men and women look like, except for when we hear the word gay, and a lot of people automatically go to a negative connotation. They automatically assume RuPaul, or some man wants to be in a dress, or very effeminate men, or, you know, anything that's remotely not masculine somehow does not fit the idea of what gay is for Black people of color. And again, but the Black church has also played a tremendous part in why we don't talk about sex and sexuality, because it's so demonized and, you know, dehumanized as what we are as individuals.
Just briefly, very briefly, we didn't get into all of the the pseudonyms for the people who might be so-and-so, and I certainly don't want you to name any names. We don't want to get sued here, but
do
give just enough information to be tantalizing about certain people who you identify, people who are, you know, the movie star or the lesbian who is verbally abusive to her partner. Has there been any retribution for that kind of storytelling?
Actually, there has not been overall. There has been certain individuals from the book who have contacted me who now are upset because they figure that people can immediately identify them. But prior to the book and while I was writing it, I did reach out to the majority of the people in the book and, you know, inform them that I was writing the book and how I was depicting them in the book. And I told them that I was changing their names and, you know, and I read to them their descriptions and things of that nature. So a lot of people were very supportive in the beginning, and a lot of people are still continuing to be supportive. But I think, you know, because now the book, you know, is festering, people are starting to read it. They're getting to pick out and, you know, identify certain people in the book.
Well,
people
Terrence,
are becoming a little nervous.
Well, Terrence, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Terrence Dean, author of Hiding in Hip Hop, On the Down Low in the Entertainment Industry from Music to Hollywood. He joined us from the NPR studios in New York City. And that's News and Notes. Nicole Childers and Christabel Nsia Boadi produced the show. Sasha Woodruff edits. Kenya Young and Devin Robbins are our directors. Our technical director is Shireen Strausberg. Marcia Caldwell is our drive engineer. Our staff includes Tony Cox, Jeffrey Bennett, Jeffrey Gardner, Roy Hurst, Anthea Raymond, Erna Champel, and Zachary Slobig. Our interns are Ashley Lisney and Blake Bishton. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org.